to Orange Pill people, to get better at it, we're going to have to start telling stories.
Mm.
That's going to be the route that we're going, you know, to do it. So just like you said, this is books, a dramatization of something that could really happen and has happened to people like, you know, Larry Lepard.
The $36 trillion in debt, a lot of people would say, oh, that sounds like a lot of money. They have no real concept of how much money that is and how unable to pay it off we are today, right?
The Bitcoin script and the way it works, it's limited. And I think that's a feature and not a bug.
On one hand, if we want Bitcoin to operate as the money we know it to be, we need to spend our Bitcoin.
I'm going to opt out of the conventional system whose schools are not working except to indoctrinate our children into whatever zeitgeist weird stuff they want to teach them. We're going to instead teach them things that are true, good, and beautiful. So that's it.
Hey there, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Devin Rose. He is the author of Chase the Seeds, a Bitcoin thriller, a book of fiction. This was a fantastic conversation. He's an awesome guy. We talked about the book, the premise, what he's hoping people draw from it, the use of literature and storytelling to orange pill the world. We also dive into educating younger generations, bringing Bitcoin into his faith, and many other things. I think you're going to enjoy this one a lot. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Devin with me. Devin, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Michael, really excited to be here today.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this conversation. We got to talk offline for a few minutes, and some of what you're working on is exciting for me personally, someone with kids, so I'm trying to find interesting ways over the years to educate them. I want to start with something really interesting. And so you wrote this book, and I want you to talk about it in just a moment, but the premise of the book includes things like bank runs, weeks-long bank holidays. You've got Bitcoin becoming sort of the only form of useful money in this novel. I think for a lot of people who aren't in Bitcoin, those things seem like, oh, it wouldn't happen. And sort of there's a recency bias, maybe a lack of understanding of history. And so I'm curious, I just want to sort of hear maybe a base case from you. How plausible do you view those scenarios to be in our world today? And do you have like a time frame over which you might anticipate them if you think they are plausible?
Yeah, great question. And in the book, the bank runs are engineered by these like globalist villains.
Mm-hmm.
But I loosely base them on the Signature Bank and Silicon Valley Bank collapses from a few years ago, which mm-hmm. some people here are going to know, because those banks were involved in Bitcoin and some other crypto stuff, which was probably why they were targeted. So in case people don't remember, when those banks, there was like a panic that happened. They said, ooh, we need more funding. The depositors tried to withdraw 25% of the total deposits, tens of billions. Of course, the bank didn't have that money, because like all banks, they lent it out a million times to other people. And so they collapsed. Well, the government stepped in, because that collapse was going to spread. And for one thing, what they were doing, they had bought all these bonds and such. Well, then the Fed had raised the interest rates so high. So then the value of all these banks' bonds had dropped so much. The banks were basically insolvent if they were forced to sell those bonds. And so the government stepped in and said, first of all, there was a $250,000, you know, FDIC insurance limit. We're going to raise that limit to make everyone whole. So they changed the rules. Then they said, there's a new program. It's called the BTFP. So that means that even if you had to sell the bonds and lose billions of dollars, you don't have to lose it. We'll just pay you the total amount that you need. So, you know, so the government showed, like, are these bank runs going to happen? Yes, they're going to happen again. But now we see it's going to be digital bank runs. And the government is willing to step in and print money and bail out whatever is needed that effectively will just keep devaluing the dollar even more and drive even more value to Bitcoin as a safe haven. So I do think we'll see these bank runs, but the government has shown that they're not going to let, you know, a Depression-era style bank run occur, in the same way.
What do you think will be the impetus then? Because, you know, it seems to me, and we're not going the political, we've had a couple of political sort of chats on the podcast recently. But it seems like the Trump administration is trying to bring down interest rates. It seems like the money printer is just getting ready to go. So if it's not going to be a loss of value in those bonds, what is it that you think initiates a bank run in any future situation?
Yeah, good question. I mean, what do we see? Even with the new administration spending just about as much money as the old administration, right? none of that slowed down. I mean, you know, there's again, this is not political. Like, I'm all for cutting the government as much as possible, and something like DOGE is kind of trying to, but it's pennies. You know, they haven't touched the defense budget, all these other things. So that debt that we have, it just keeps going up. There's no stopping it. And you know, you probably have seen Larry Lippard's book, The Big Print, Lynn Alden's Broken Money, all of these new books that are basically saying the same thing. We hit a point where it's simply unsustainable, and we have to actually issue new debt to pay for the existing interest on the debt, you know, monetize the debt. Well, when something isn't sustainable, eventually it dies, it crashes. How that happens, it probably doesn't happen at like the big banks, that these, you know, systemically important banks, as the government now calls them, that they'll never let fail. It probably happens with, oh, look at that country over there, Egypt, Lebanon, Turkey. They're having lots of problems. Oh, look what's happening in Japan. You know, the Bank of Japan can't control their currency and their bonds. Oh, that breaks. And then that spreads over because all these people had the yen carry trade. So in other words, all of this financialization and machinery that the government and these central banks have been able to kind of keep together, it eventually breaks and falls apart. They will print, they will devalue our money even more, to a massive amount, more than COVID, more than anything. And what's going to be valuable? Well, things like Bitcoin. And I think gold too, anything that's really scarce and is still going to have value. So that's kind of how I see it playing out over the next, you know, 10 years.
Yeah, I think people are going to learn the importance and significance of counterparty risk in the coming decade, you know, when we begin to see, because I've always heard, like early on in my, I haven't heard this as much lately, but early on in my Bitcoin journey, I remember listening to podcasts, and people would always say, you know, I think Greg Foss and probably Larry Lippard, guys like that, would say, you know, the U.S. will sort of be the last domino to fall, but it'll be this cascade that begins with, you know, I mean, maybe even a large, you know, relatively stable, you know, compared to many economy like Japan, who could become problematic. Because, you know, we saw Lebanon in 2019 and no material impact on the world, but it's probably a more isolated, you know, less global economy, you know, coming out of Lebanon than a place like Japan, for example. So I'm curious, what made you decide to write a book in general and in a work of fiction specifically? Because my understanding is you worked mostly in technology for a long, long time. Do you also have a writing background? Do you have a finance background? You seem to have a really good grasp of sort of the economics of the macro, you know, picture that in the world today.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. Finance, I'm totally self-taught. I don't know anything beyond what, you know, probably you've learned. But of course, COVID woke me up a lot. And 10 years ago, I got into Bitcoin. And that also started me on the journey of, hey, wait a second. What's going on with our money? What is this Federal Reserve? And read The Creature from Jekyll Island and other books. There weren't as many books back then, 10 years ago, as there are now. Now we're getting this huge renaissance of books, which is exciting. Yeah, I'm a software developer and by trade for 20, 25 years. So the tech aspect of it was very interesting to me, of Bitcoin. And then also it took me down the altcoin rabbit hole, which I did not escape that. And it was only maybe 3 years ago that I realized, oh, Bitcoin is, you know, the way. But I talk with people about Bitcoin as I'm sure many have, and eyes glaze over. People think you know, it's a Ponzi scheme, you're a scammer, it's for drug people. That's been changing because it gets more mainstream, but I thought, what is it that moves people? Well, most people aren't going to read a nonfiction book about Bitcoin, but they might read a story. They might read a thriller that's a page turner where it's not clobber you over the head with Bitcoin. It's, oh, look how organically Bitcoin becomes valuable in the book. And the main character in the book, whose name's Edmund, he's a 20-something-year-old computer programmer. Well, he doesn't care. He doesn't know anything about Bitcoin. It's his best friend who's going along with him in the scavenger hunt, who's the Bitcoin guy, and ends up kind of saving the day and letting them continue their quest when this bank run happens, because he's got the Bitcoin. So my hope was is that people who will read the book, and now they're going to encounter Bitcoin and say, oh, hey, I could see how that could happen.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think that's a really smart and thoughtful way of approaching it, because what I've learned I'm no expert orange piller by any stretch. I mean, I've gotten a few people kind of, you know, allocating a little bit here or there. I have not gotten any hardcore Bitcoiners in my life. Maybe one who I've kind of converted from altcoins, but he was a little bit down the rabbit hole. I think I finished The Big Print by Larry Lepard recently, and I think what I liked about that as a work of nonfiction is it's still told a story of like his story, you know, of you know, his grandfather, his father, and then they've all been screwed basically to some degree by the existing system, by being sort of directionally correct on things at different times. And basically got rug pulled in certain different circumstances. And to me, that was, as much as I love The Bitcoin Standard, it's one of the first books I'd hand out to people. I think The Big Print would be up there for me too now, because there's sort of more of a story and a narrative to it. But I think maybe what many of us, as we seek to orange pill friends, family, loved ones, what we struggle to do is tell the story of what's going on, because The Big Print for me was maybe the first time, as many things as I, these bits and pieces as I've picked up along the way, the last few years, you know, going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, it was the first time I felt like I'd read something like that cohesively articulates the problem. And then he talks about Bitcoin at the end. And it kind of sounds to me like maybe that's what you've done with a more engaging work of fiction is sort of illustrate like a sort of a hypothetical, but also this is kind of how the world is, you know, like, you know, this, these globalist villains, as you describe them, and as people begin to piece that together, the rest sort of becomes believable. Is that maybe a good way of framing what you've done here? And feel free to elaborate maybe on the premise of the book and, you know, without giving away the whole plot, I think people should buy it and read it.
Yeah. The book is called Chasing the Seeds. Chasing the Seeds. And on the cover of the book, which I probably have one here I can grab. There's a, actually, hold on one sec.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, for all the video watchers, sorry if not. Well, there's a building on the book cover that some people know and some people don't. It's actually the Svalbard Global Seed Vault in Norway, in an island north of Norway, and it's used to store heirloom seeds in case of global disaster. It's stored in the permafrost in the mountain, and then they could basically repopulate the flora of an area that was, you know, maybe a bomb went off or a war or something. So it's Chasing the Seeds, and in the book, a 20-something-year-old computer programmer from Austin, he's doing his thing. He finds this clue in his father's book. His father died when he was 12. It was an old economics book of his father, written by Murray Rothbard, which some Austrian economics people will recognize. So it starts him on a scavenger hunt where one clue leads to another. He goes on it with his best friend. There's a rogue FBI agent who is chasing him, though, because the rogue FBI agent suspects what the clues are going to lead to. And so it's a race between the bad guy and the hero, who's just a normal guy, you know, to get these seeds and find out what what did his father leave him, and who was his father? So, yeah, like, as you said, what it describes are, I tried it, this is set in contemporary times, it's considered realistic fiction. So no one has superpowers, you know, it's not paranormal. And what happens is, like you're saying with Larry LaPard's book, it's, well, what if we put that in a fictional scenario? What could develop? Are there these globalists and these people who want to usher in the central bank digital currency? Well, we know that there are those people. You know, we hear that from the European Central Bank. They want a CBDC so that they control everything. There's people in the U.S. who want to have a central bank digital currency. There's plausible paths where they could end up using Tether or Circle or one of these stable coins to kind of to do that. So in the book, it's incorporating these different ideas, you know, similar to what Larry LaPard, which, by the way, I got to meet him at the BitBlock Boom conference in Dallas a few weeks ago, which was very cool. And I actually got to give him a copy of my book. He had sold out of all of his books, so he was just handing out cards and signing. And you know, at that conference, too, briefly, Dante Cook, who used to be with Swan, now he's with Simply Bitcoin. He gave one of the talks and basically said, to orange pill people, to get better at it, we're going to have to start telling stories. That's going to be the route that we're going, you know, to do it. So just like you said, this is books, a dramatization of something that, that could really happen and has happened to people like, you know, Larry LaPard.
Yeah, I love that approach because I really do think that's just traditionally where Bitcoiners have fallen down. We, you know, we jump right. We're so excited about Bitcoin that we fail to maybe connect it to a problem that it solves. And the biggest hurdle in there is that most people just don't understand that there's a problem right now, right? Like, we've been talking about mountains of debt and bank bailouts, and, you know, we had a couple of bank failures, you know, a couple of years ago, but nothing catastrophic, right? I mean, maybe, you know, there was an isolated group who was probably, you know, heavily impacted by that. But most of us are getting poorer every day, and groceries are becoming harder to afford and finding a place to live and all of that. But it's what makes it so insidious is how subtle it is and how slowly it all happens. And if we can redirect people to the root cause of all of this, and and most importantly, I think the unsustainability of it all, that we have $36 trillion in debt. A lot of people would say, oh, that sounds like a lot of money. They have no real concept of how much money that is and how unable to pay it off we are today, right? And then what are the ramifications of our inability to pay off that debt in any meaningful way? And I think if people could sort of just begin to wrap their head around that, then telling the story of sound money and why historically gold has been great, but Bitcoin now builds upon that and is so much better, especially for a digital age and in a global economy, I think we'll see a lot of traction. But I think we need more people doing the sort of thing that you're doing. Because, like, I'm going to read your book when it arrives. I'm not typically a fiction reader, but this is the sort of thing that intrigues me. And part of the reason, besides everything we've talked about, storytelling, orange pilling, is I've got kids. And we were talking offline a little bit, and I want to linger on this subject for a few minutes because I think it's important. Is Bitcoiners are going to have more and more power. We tend to be a group that seems set on having families, unlike many who seem to be having fewer kids. You mentioned that your 14-year-old, I think you have a 14-year-old son, is sort of engaged with the book. And I'm curious, what sort of takeaways has he had, and what was your hope? You know, walking away, like, what flips have been switched, what new mindsets maybe have been formed in reading a book like this?
Yeah, totally. And I wanted my son to be able to read a book like this. And actually, I read a book series, or I started reading a book series by a guy named Doug Casey. He's kind of famous in libertarian circles. His kind of site is called International Man. So some people know who he is and others don't. But he co-wrote a series that he kind of espouses similar ideas, though instead of, you know, Bitcoin being the answer, it ends up being gold because he's a little bit of an older guy. But the book has all this kind of adult stuff that I don't want my children to read. And I thought, well, I want to write something that's clean, that doesn't have all that, but just has also the same good principles and truth, and it's an engaging story. And so I did that. And what was interesting was my son, he was saving up money first to buy a boat motor, but now he's getting close to being able to drive, and now he wants to save it for a car. Well, he was just saving cash. He had $600 or whatever he'd save for a year, and it's just sitting there. Meanwhile, as we've seen, even he realizes like the inflation's happening. His $600 every year is just going down in value. And I said, well, son, one thing you could do would be to put it into Bitcoin. He said, well, what if it, you know, goes down? I said, yeah, if it goes down, it'll go down. And, you know, you'll have less dollars if you cash it out, but probably it'll go up over a long time. Well, this is like a year and a half ago. So he put in $600, then he, you know, another few hundred dollars as he got more. Well, he started buying in, and it was $25,000. So it was kind of, you know, we'd hit the bottom at 16,000 or whatever, and it had come up to that 25K level.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's watching it. Okay, now Bitcoin doubled to 50,000. Okay, now it went to 70,000. It was touching the previous all-time high. Then it hit 100,000, and he started getting excited because guess what? His money just went to $3,000 to $4,000 when he had put in 800. You know, he tripled, quadrupled his money. Him seeing that and realizing what this could do for him. I mean, he's a total Bitcoiner now. Like, he tells his friends about it. They can't believe it. But he tells them, look, this is what I did. And it's also been good because, as we've seen, we've had this pullback, you know, down to 70, 80, 85K, whatever we're at. And he said, well, I should have sold it. And I said, well, you could have sold it. You know, maybe that was the right decision. He said, well, did we hit the top? I said, I don't think we hit the top this bull run, but it might have been. No one knows. And therefore, he's having to go through, which, as you know, the way to really learn is you put real money into it. You watch it go up and down, and you feel the pain of it going down and have to be strong not to capitulate, and you know, sell at the low and then buy back when it's higher, which is the opposite, right, of what you should do. Well, I didn't learn that until, whatever, 40 years old, and he's learning it at 15 years old. So it's been a very realistic thing for him.
I think the importance, though, is having enough knowledge to have high conviction to hold through those periods where you feel like your wealth is deteriorating. Is there, are those conversations you have? Has he taken anything away from the book to understand that there's, I understand in the moment it's, you know, it can be, especially your, you know, 14-year-old kid, it can feel very emotional, like your dreams of buying a car are, you know, evaporating before your eyes. Like for me, the dips just, you know, it just doesn't faze me. But I think part of that is, you know, literally 1500 hours of listening to podcasts, reading all the books that I think most people would be familiar with in the Bitcoin space. Is there any approach you've taken to impart some of that wisdom so he doesn't just view it as a number go up, oops, it's dipping, number go up again, technology, and rather there's this whole macro picture going on that this is the safe haven, you know, and like even to think about like, okay, when you can't afford to buy a car, and I understand, especially the 16-year-old kid, you want to have a car, you want to drive it around, you want to be able to afford gas, but like helping him to think through like, what's your time preference on the purchase of this car? Are you going to buy the most expensive car you can get just because you think it's cool and you're so excited right now? Or someday when you want to buy a house or when you want to, you know, begin raising children in an increasingly expensive fiat world, you know, maybe holding on to some of that Bitcoin, not such a bad idea. Like how do you approach those subjects?
Yeah, well, Michael, and this is something I think, you know, your children are going to benefit from too. You've learned all these things and you're going to be imparting them to your children as you learn them and as they grow. And obviously, you know, you can't tell everything to a 5-year-old that you can to a 10-year-old, to a 15-year-old. You know, they can understand, right, you know, better as they get older. Well, but my son and I, we've had lots of conversations about, hey, what's happening with the economy? What's happening with, oh, this friend, you know, he's lost his job or he doesn't have money. Well, where are we saving the money? What are different ways to save? What's the risks associated with them? And then what you said too, and also just painting the picture of, hey, he understands now, like, yeah, where did the Federal Reserve come from?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, you want me to pay you in Federal Reserve notes? Because that's what it says on here. It's a Federal Reserve note. These things that no one thinks about, he's already thinking about at a young age. He's now realized too, oh, if I spend my Bitcoin, now I don't have the Bitcoin. I do want a car. And he wants to buy a truck because some of his friends have trucks. And we're out in kind of the country and that's manly. And I'm like, it is manly. And I said, my first car though was a Honda Civic, which is not manly. But the Civic is cheaper to maintain and it takes less gas. And so you have to decide which do you value more. And what he's doing now is he's trying to work more to just make cash so that he doesn't have to spend as much of his Bitcoin. So if he can earn cash and use as much cash as possible to buy that vehicle, well, maybe he only has to cash out half his Bitcoin, you know. But I'm also on the, I'm not on the hodl till you die and never spend Bitcoin. You know, I'm on the, hey, there's things in life that you need or want or can make life better for you or others. I'm happy to spend my Bitcoin if for those important things. Now, I don't want to spend all of it, but you know, there's things that can move the needle for people. And sometimes that's something bad, like paying for their, you know, an expensive medical thing they needed. Other things are, oh, if I donate this money, this organization can do some really good work. You know, from my wife's perspective, she wants to spend some of our Bitcoin to renovate our house. So my wife and I have had lots of conversations about the time preference and the value.
I can only imagine. Yeah, I think that's a really hard balancing act because I completely agree with you. Like we're put here on this earth and I think we'll talk a little bit about your Catholic faith in a bit because I want to orange pill my church too, but I think we're put here on this earth to for something well beyond storing up monetary value for generations. I want to do that, but also there are so many variables. At least I'd just be curious to hear your thoughts on this, but. On one hand, if we want Bitcoin to operate as the money we know it to be, we need to spend our Bitcoin and replace it. You know, if you want to continue to use it as a savings vehicle, spend and replace, I think is a really, really smart way to do that. At the same time, there's going to come a day probably where many people say, okay, I do want to, you know, build a home. I do want to put in a pool and like make memories with my kids. Or I want, you know, there's so many valuable things. What sort of the way I framed it with my wife is I'll spend my Bitcoin at a conference or on coffee or, you know, if someone's accepting Bitcoin, I'll spend and replace today. But when it comes to like big purchases, I want to make sure that what it's done is it's reoriented my mental framework toward this needs to have a very positive ROI in terms of my lifestyle and a new truck. And, you know, all the gadgets and toys and things that I'd love to have just don't fit the bill, right? My wife wants a swimming pool. That fits the bill. If we can have a swimming pool in the next few years and we can make memories out in the backyard with the kids, I think there comes a day where that makes sense. To the extent that I still have some dry powder and fiat to cover that, I'd rather spend that than my Bitcoin. That becomes increasingly hard as I reallocate more and more to Bitcoin. I earn in Bitcoin now, you know, but I'd just be curious, yeah, like how those conversations go and maybe to what extent have you been able to help your wife understand that? Has she gotten on board? If so, like what's the way you framed it for her?
Yeah, these are great questions. And I'll share some things with you too. First on the wife front, you know, I've had Bitcoin for 10 years now. Only in the past year has my wife been on board with it.
Mm.
So before that, it was my thing. It was, you know, she didn't care. It was silly. Why am I spending all this time on it? What can it do for us? You know, now she gets it and she realizes, oh, And she both wants to save it, but she also wants to spend it because she has things that she wants, like a house renovation. There's trade-offs in life and there's compromises in life, right? And people are different. So especially when you get married, you're marrying someone, and it's not that you get everything that you want all the time, and you know, the other person gets nothing. That's not love, right? There has to be a mutual gift going on. And so I said, yeah, we can sell some of the Bitcoin and do some things you want to do. We'll have to make sure that there are things that really do help, right? There really are true improvements. But with regard to the Bitcoin as, let me put it this way. So this is a personal thing. So the book, my book I dedicated to my daughter, Josephine, and not to bring up something sad, but a little over a year ago, she died of leukemia when she was 11 years old. I was writing this book actually in the hospital, there in the hospital with her. You know, we just in the hospital for months, you know, of treatment before they realized it was terminal and they couldn't do anything. And she actually we had saved Bitcoin for her too, for her future. But you know, there when she was dying, you know, having Bitcoin is not important, right? What was important was spending time together. Those memories that you've made, that was what was important. And of course, there's the old phrase, you can't take it with you. And that's true. And it helped me to put it in perspective. And, you know, as Christians, it's like, yes, there's no sense in making Bitcoin an idol. Don't make money an idol. Don't make Bitcoin an idol. It's a means. I think that we haven't gotten to the something unpopular among Bitcoiners that we'll get to at the end. But one unpopular thing I would say with Bitcoiners is, and I'm not blaming them, some of them don't have faith in God. One. Two, they see Bitcoin and how good it is and how corrupt the world is. And they see it as this like shining thing that is legitimate. It's really good, right? But it's not God. And you can't replace God with sound money. That you just, it doesn't work. And so people might not like it when I say that. But I think even Bitcoiners who are not people of faith will realize, yeah, like at the end of the day, like you can't hold your Bitcoin and give it a hug. The Bitcoin doesn't take care of you when you're old and feeble and need someone to, you know, feed you your Jell-O. So those are just some, you know, kind of, I guess, thoughts on it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think there's a trap in Bitcoin. You know, we often say Bitcoin fixes this. And what I think maybe sort of my macro view of what Bitcoin fixes is it fixes a lot of incentives, right? Like it doesn't, it fixes the incentives of politicians, of individuals, of really important stuff. But even on a gold standard, there's been crime, there's been war. I think we can stop a lot of the forever wars, like just the total nonsensical wars. But I don't think that we just have, you know, utopian peace and, you know, a big love fest just because we're on a Bitcoin standard. I think there will always be evil. And it's easy to imagine that because so many things are downstream of broken money, that if you just cut that, you know, off at the head, then, you know, everything else just kind of follows and gets good. I think everything does get a lot better. But I think it's a trap to imagine that the world is utopian because of that, right? I mean, there's so many variables that extend beyond money. And part of it's just, you know, fallible humans. And part of it's there are still incentives that exist outside of money. Some people are going to pay the price for not taking personal responsibility, even when there's not, you know, checks being sent to them by the government. I'm hopeful. Yes. for a much better world, but I'm, as often as I've probably said, Bitcoin fixes this. I would caution people from assuming that Bitcoin fixes everything, because it simply doesn't.
Right.
And, I'm with you. So, we'll circle back actually to education and kids, because we talked offline a little bit about the classical education. What was it, though? You said you got into Bitcoin a decade ago. You sort of went down the altcoin path for a while. What led you down the altcoin path, and then what brought you back to sort of Bitcoin maximalism?
Yeah, I have a good friend who turns out to be a big guy in the Ethereum world. And I think in 2015, Ethereum was preparing for their ICO, and he was so jazzed about Ethereum. And he had Bitcoin, and he wanted me to buy Ethereum. And I looked at it and was like, well, you know, I invested in stocks and stuff. And it's like, back then it was like someone telling me to buy AMD when I didn't even own Intel, or telling me to buy Pepsi stock when I don't own Coca-Cola. Like, no, you buy the number one. You always want to hold number one. The number two might flip it eventually, which we've seen, you know, AMD has done a lot better over the past, whatever, 10 years. But, and so I bought Bitcoin instead of Ethereum, and I started learning about it. Well, but as he's talking to me about Ethereum, and I'm a computer programmer, he's like, Bitcoin, you know, you can't program it like you can Ethereum. Ethereum's the world computer, and it has a Turing complete programming, you know, language VM. And I was like, cool, yeah, that makes sense. And so I bought some Ethereum. This is in the early days, right? This is 2015, 2016. So it was leading up to the 2017 bull run, but that hadn't really happened yet. Well, then it was like, oh, look at this. There's this XRP. All I have to do is go on this Slovenian exchange called Bitstamp somehow. And then I can buy XRP, which is going to be the new way that banks transfer. You know, there wasn't all the information there is now that exposes all this stuff, that exposes the pre-mine and exposes all the shenanigans that have gone on. And it was very much like, oh, yeah, this is going to revolutionize everything, all these things. Well, so I went down then the altcoin rabbit hole and had, you know, in the 2017 bull run, had Bitcoin, 30 different altcoins. And then that's two when we had the block size wars, and then Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin Gold and all these other nonsense ones. And even with Bitcoin Cash, I was like, And after a while, I sold all of it and just bought back Bitcoin, which is what a lot of people did. So it took me about 4 years, probably 2021 or something, before I realized, wait a sec, Ethereum has a pre-mine, it has a founder, it has a centralized, you know, organization that in person that kind of drives the stuff. Oh, now they've switched from proof of work to proof of stake. That changes the fundamental nature of it. And then on the consensus page, which is that's by Lubin, who's one of the main founders with Vitalik of Ethereum, they were talking about how, hey, Ethereum can be used to implement a central bank digital currency. Now, my head was exploding. It's like, why are the Ethereum people promoting a central bank digital currency? That's crazy. And so I dumped the altcoins and dumped almost all my Ethereum. I've got one. I even bought an NFT. I have one NFT, and I'm keeping some Ethereum around because you have to have Ethereum to sell. And I'm hoping this NFT somehow goes up in value and I can sell it, which, as you know, is probably a fool's dream, but you know, that was what happened.
Fun to play around sometimes. I didn't linger in the altcoin space very long, because I was fortunate. I've only been in Bitcoin for coming up on 3 years, and so I like to say I was like forged in the bear market of 2022 when Celsius collapsed, FTX collapsed, and I was kind of following Bitcoiners I never understood the tech deeply on altcoins, but I was like, I don't know who the winner is going to be. I'll have like a diversified crypto portfolio or whatever. And it turned out that the Bitcoiners, everything they were saying about Celsius and about FTX, they were right about everything. And I was like, what are the odds that these guys were right about everything and they're wrong about their thesis related to Bitcoin specifically? And so, you know, by, I don't know, mid late 2022, I became a Bitcoin maxi. And I'd be curious if you agree with this. I think maybe what the reason people get sidetracked by altcoins is, well, first of all, I think there's some unit bias, like, well, Bitcoin's too expensive or whatever for me. And like, it's a failure to recognize the big picture. But I think if you come into Bitcoin believing it to be sound money, the most likely candidate to replace, you know, any other fiat or gold or anything in global trade, it's very, and if you can really stay focused on that, I think it's easy to stay in Bitcoin, not get distracted. But when you begin to hear all of these other features and alleged benefits of these other coins, and you lose sight of sound money, it's very easy to be distracted. And my sense is maybe that is kind of what happened to you. Like there were like all these other things. And for a bit, you know, you kind of forgot like, well, Bitcoin, you know, Chancellor on the second brink of, like you forget that stuff and you get sidetracked by like the tech and the cool features and, you know, the bells and whistles. Is that kind of your take on why the altcoin space distracts people so often?
Oh yeah, totally. Bitcoin becomes the boring thing. And even among some of my Bitcoin friends, it's like, well, Bitcoin is kind of ossifying. There's no innovation happening. The world's moving fast. Surely we're going to have something cooler, better. Store value is not enough. It needs to be a medium of exchange. And even after I explained to him, I said, well, I've learned that something starts off as a collectible, then store of value, then medium of exchange, then unit of account. And we see with that store of value phase that we're really at, it also can become then a reserve asset held on balance sheets, which is beginning to occur. And it can displace bonds and gold and dollars. But yeah, I, especially coming from a tech background, I was like, well, I mean, you can program anything you want on these other blockchains. That means it's just dependent on your imagination. Bitcoin can't, right? Like the Bitcoin script and the way it works, it's limited. And I think that's a feature and not a bug, right? Mm-hmm. But at that time I thought, I believed in all the hype that, you know, just like the internet disrupted XYZ, you know, traditional news media got disrupted by the internet. And eventually, you know, you had Airbnb and grocery delivery and everything else, right? Buying things online. Well, blockchain is going to disrupt everything else by decentralizing it. You know, if you have Uber as a centralized company that does ride sharing, well, now you're going to have decentralized ride sharing. You know, why not? Now, of course, that I don't think any of the projects I've ever bought, I had bought over the years before I dumped it, have succeeded. Mm-hmm. You know, in whatever their goal was. And then some of them too, like Ethereum, you know, they couldn't just be like, hey, we're going to be this whatever NFT platform or something. It was always changing. And it was going to be the world computer, but it's also going to be ultrasound money because we're going to be better than Bitcoin. Something about these altcoins, they really always want to knock off Bitcoin and say, well, yeah, but we're going to be faster and a faster block time with a higher throughput. In watching them fail, and as you entered into the perfect time because everything's bled out basically in these past 3 years. Instead of having the altcoin season, okay, this bull run is different. There has not been an altcoin season, and that has been crushing to altcoiners. It's been crushing to my friend, I'm still his friend. He's the Ethereum guy. And he's still waiting for it, right? I had a big argument with him on the phone. It wasn't a mean argument. It was just, you know, as men argue. And I was arguing for Bitcoin and was like, I dumped my Ethereum, dude. Like, this, you need to like basically get off the Ethereum train. And he was like, no, dude, you're making stuff up. And I haven't called him back, of course, to say, well, I guess I was right and you were wrong, because that's a really annoying thing to do. But also because there could be an altcoin season. I don't know. Even if there is, though, we see the trend over time. When it comes to money, Bitcoin is going to be the king.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I think for a lot of those guys, it's probably the same as like the Peter Schiffs and the other gold bugs is they've sort of fought very publicly and, you know, vocally about for their particular cause. It's a really hard pill to swallow when you realize I was wrong. I probably give, you know, and like, I think the proof is in the pudding, right? With, you know, ETH, even if we do have a bit of a pump for some of these altcoins in the next year, because global liquidity increases and, you know, there's just more money around to go chase after these things. I still think it's going to continue to diminish in Bitcoin terms as it has. And unfortunately, what a lot of people are going to see is just the dollar denominated value go up, and they're going to think that they're winning in some way for a bit longer. And so I think that we're going to continue to see the trend for a while longer. And because Bitcoin doesn't have a marketing budget, because it doesn't have a CEO, it doesn't have a dedicated team, you know, pushing a particular narrative. I mean, heck, Bitcoiners are arguing on Twitter with each other all the time about, you know, any number of topics. I think we'll still see some of that. And same thing with gold. I think right now gold is the store of value that most of the world knows and to some degree understands. And it's the reason we're seeing all-time highs in gold is because if you're concerned about high inflation, a loss of confidence in government debt, then gold seems a pretty reasonable place to go if you don't understand Bitcoin. Or if you kind of do understand Bitcoin, but you're unconvinced that it's necessarily going to win in the global free market. But to me, that just feels so obvious, you know, like listening to otherwise really smart guys like Peter Schiff talk about how gold could be used as money. It's like, you're back to centralized issuers and IOUs and trust. And like, what's the point? Let's just circumvent all that and go to Bitcoin. But I think he's been beating that gold drum for 30 years or however long it's been to where it's his baby. He just can't, you know, I mean, the ability to swallow your pride becomes very difficult after that amount of time. Yes. Kudos to the Larry Lepards of the world who have swallowed their pride and said, I'm going to pick the winning horse, not the horse that I've always bet on, you know?
Yeah.
So I want to switch topics here. You're a devout Catholic. You mentioned in some of our correspondence back and forth that, you know, part of what you're trying to do is bring Bitcoin into, you know, your faith community. And I'm curious what that looks like and to what extent you've had success or just run into walls and, you know, faced obstacles. How has that process been and what sort of approach are you taking?
Yeah, good question. I would not say I've had tremendous success.
Don't worry, no one has. No one has.
Though it was kind of cool, briefly at the BitBlock Boom conference, there was a guy next to me and he said, hey, I'm a preacher and I've made a resolution with my denomination to have Bitcoin. And he said, the resolution is not going to pass. It's not going to succeed. And so I talked with him later, and actually it was a Baptist church in a town I used to live in Texas. But I was like, oh, that's cool. He's trying to, you know, do this too. To me, this is a no-brainer because with regard to Bitcoin, because it's sound money. Right now we have unsound money and the government steals from us through it, which is totally wrong. Right? It's completely immoral and unethical. So it's a no-brainer. We should be able to support Bitcoin. And as far as the Catholic Church go in teachings, there's nothing that could be against Bitcoin. That said, oftentimes the, you know, leadership of the Catholic Church does not move quickly, and they don't often talk about kind of non-faith secular topics. So they're not weighing in on economics or whatever, right? So you don't hear, like, the Pope's never said, hey, you should buy Bitcoin. And most of these prelates too, you know, they're like boomer age, which is you point out, like, you know, boomers succeeded without Bitcoin, right? And so why hey, they've made it in life and they're going on their cruises and everything else and they didn't need Bitcoin, so why should they even be interested or talk about it? Which is remarkable. Then when one of them does figure it out, you're like, ooh, that's cool. I've written some articles, I've done some videos, and amongst my Catholic circle locally, many of the people have orange-pilled and bought Bitcoin. So it's been much more, and where I am, it's a little bit more of like a preparation-minded community, a little bit more of a self-sufficiency, let's help each other out. Hey, things might get bad, not in some zombie apocalypse kind of way, but just wow, everything's more expensive. We can't afford anything. So that's been successful. A friend of mine named Eric Sammons is actually writing a book that a Catholic publisher is publishing that's The Catholic Case for Bitcoin. It's going to come out this summer. And so there's progress being made in that direction. I think this is going to be a very long battle, you will. And probably Protestant communities, they're smaller and more fragmented, but they're going to probably be more successful in here and there being able to, you know, convince small groups to get in on this. You know, what do you think?
Yeah, I think in the I go to a Baptist church. I wouldn't consider myself necessarily Baptist, but we seem to have found a good fit. You know, with I think you know in terms of you know the teaching and sort of the approach to our faith, it aligns. I think my sense is with the Catholic Church, it seems more. Probably a more of an uphill battle simply because it's more centralized, right? Like each, you kind of look up to the next stage of leadership, you know, above you and I don't know for sure exactly the hierarchy, but ultimately it kind of boils up to the Pope and, you know, with, you know, the sort of these disparate Protestant denominations, you know, they tend to be much smaller. And so it might be more accessible. And I think, you know, for someone like my church, and one of my goals is this year is to orange pill my church and get them to buy some Bitcoin. It's a decision that they can make on their own, right? Independently as a standalone church. I don't know how that would work with like a parish, but I still think it's an uphill battle. And I think it's really an uphill battle for the same reason that it's an uphill battle to orange pill your friend. And it's sort of a function of recency bias, a lack of attention. Like, you know, they're trying to stay afloat, make sure they're covering their expenses today. How much do we really have to set aside and allocate to this thing anyway? But I think there's also, I don't know if this is your experience. I'd be curious. I think there are relatively few people in general, and certainly within sort of the Christian community who are innovative enough and forward thinking to pause and say, what are the implications of me looking into Bitcoin or not looking into Bitcoin 10 years from now? And, you know, I see that the same thing with my friends, like, you know, my best friend in the entire world, I've bought some Bitcoin for him that he doesn't even know about, but he's like told me, he's like, oh yeah, I really need to look into that. Maybe buy some. Or, and it's like, that was, you know, 2 years ago, he's been telling me, you know, that since. And he's, you know, he has a baby now. He's busy with that. He's got a busy job. He's just trying to stay afloat. You know, they moved into a new house, so he's trying to keep ahead of some of the expenses that have gone into like setting up a nursery. And it's like his mind is in so many places. Understandably so. I get it. But what I notice is just this high time preference behavior, because you're busy with all these other things, just trying to stay afloat. You haven't lowered your time preference to address, is what I'm doing even going to be a successful strategy 10, 20, 30 years from now? I think the answer for many people, unfortunately, is no. I think that's the same sort of thing with the church. It's like they think as long as we can continue to have positive cash flow each month, you know, maybe set a little bit aside here and there, and we'll put it into a, you know, money market fund or buy some bonds, or maybe they invest in stocks. I have no visibility into our church treasury at the moment. Mm-hmm. They think that's sufficient. So
yeah.
I really don't think it's a whole lot different than maybe my experience and struggle with individuals. I guess is what I'm saying. Would you agree? Or is there anything that maybe you feel it makes it uniquely challenging for an institution?
I bet you've seen this and I think this cuts across probably Protestant and Catholic, and that's, Christians can tend also to super spiritualize things, right? And it's like, well, why are you caring about money so much? You
know, yeah.
Doesn't it say money's the root of all evil? And you're like, well, no, it says the love of money is the root of all evil. It's like, oh, well, whatever. and so it's kind of like, oh, you're right. You're putting this thing like it's so important. I just live my life and work and make my money and just, you know, live. I don't try to like hoard all this money, and you know, so it could kind of become that type of thing.
I think the one way I'm thinking about sort of framing it is the secular, and not to make it overtly political, but like the secular far left has captured media, they've captured entertainment, they've captured government to a large extent. They've captured so many of these core institutions. And to a large extent, they've even captured the global church with a capital C. And that's why we're having fights over things that historically have been more or less decided amongst the church, what scripture says about, a particular topic. And sort of my pitch, or the pitch that I'm maybe anticipating using, is if you want to continue in this paradigm where the secular left in particular has just completely occupied all of these institutions, then keep doing what you're doing. It's not working to gain you any ground. If you want to project yourself 20 years into the future and say, what does the world look like? You have a chance right now to purchase what I believe will be the money that everyone uses for all global trade at some point in the next, call it 20 years. And that's not a formal prediction. That's just sort of a timeline I sort of think on. And suddenly then you kind of have to pause, if someone presents that as a potential situation or base case, you can either just be completely negligent and say, I don't care, willfully ignorant, or you can say, if there's something to what you're saying, then we at least have a moral obligation to at least visit this as a topic, at least read a book, at least understand why are you as a Christ follower so excited about this thing and spending time that you don't have to spend to try convincing us to consider this. And maybe that's a way of framing it, yeah. I don't care about MicroStrategy. I'm buying Bitcoin. I'm not buying MicroStrategy. Kudos to Taylor for figuring this stuff out, but I don't care if they own Bitcoin. That gives me and those who philosophically align with me no additional influence in the world.
Mm-hmm.
None. I think orange pilling my church, orange pilling local businesses, that I care about.
Yes.
That has a material impact on certainly my local world. But I think over time on the global world. Yeah. I think it's such a hard conversation to strike up because the FUD that's been out there, magic internet money, too much energy
scheme.
All those things are like, it's an unspoken battle that you're fighting because they have that in their mind already,
Right. But you made a good point, and that's, how's it been working out to follow the conventional regime narrative this whole time where we've lost influence, we've had money stolen from us, our traditional values have been completely degraded. Doesn't seem to be going well. Maybe we shouldn't listen to them and we should try something different.
Yeah.
It's obvious to me that's the case. So I think people, they're going to see this more and more as we go along, because for one thing, the number does go up over time and the proof's in the pudding.
It's like Neil Diamond says, money talks. I think all of that I'll continue to talk with you about this offline about how I think about this strategically. We're getting close to time. So I do want to turn our attention to education. We're homeschooling my daughter who's in kindergarten. Got to run here in a little bit to go to an Easter party for my preschool son, but he'll be homeschooled in a year and a half or two. And talk about classical education and maybe where you think Bitcoin fits into this. I know that's not necessarily structurally part of many of those curriculums, but I think probably as you think about, the Bitcoin rabbit hole, it goes so many directions. It touches so many of these things. How do you think about classical education? Maybe talk a little bit about what you're working on.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. For those who don't know, classical education is one that focuses on teaching kids to be critical thinkers, focusing on character and virtue, and not just can they score well for the college entrance exam or can they be really good at sports and get a scholarship. So it's not just the teacher tells you things and you write it down and regurgitate it. It's a Socratic dialogue type of class where the teacher facilitates the students through questions, figuring out problems. And Bitcoin definitely can be part of that. Matter of fact, so we're starting a school called the Chesterton Academy in Tyler, Texas, which is in Northeast Texas, and named after G.K. Chesterton, who was a famous Christian from England 100 years ago. Very prolific writer, brilliant thinker. And so this school will be a high school, and it focuses on not just the math and science, the STEM, but also rhetoric, writing, the arts, music. So really making a complete human person who can face the world. So like, I'm going to incorporate Bitcoin into the school because I'm getting to have an influence on it. We homeschooled also, and so I'm a big homeschooling fan. If we weren't homeschooling, which we will until we send our son to this school that we're starting, we would go with a classical route. So I think people are rediscovering the classical approach. It focuses on the great Western canon, Aristotle, Plato, Aquinas, Augustine, all the way. And it's another way of saying, I'm going to opt out of the conventional system whose schools are not working except to indoctrinate our children into whatever zeitgeist weird stuff they want to teach them. We're going to instead teach them things that are true, good, and beautiful. So that's it.
Yeah, I love that approach. What I was telling you before we hit record was sort of the way I'm approaching this. And part of the reason I'm very grateful that you've written this book, I'm excited to read it, is because I think a lot of the education that we're going to provide our kids, I'll be pretty hands-on with them when it makes more sense and some of the fundamentals of what I want to teach are more age appropriate. But I think it's really hard to beat reading and exploring topics through just really good literature. And I think you learn how good writers write. You learn about new topics at the same time. In your case, like with fiction, I think it sparks your imagination. It gets you thinking. You know, it's less off. Again, I don't read a lot of fiction, but it's one of those things you kind of fall asleep thinking about and kind of playing out how might this work, or is that really how the world works, or you know. So I sense that a lot of what we need to do is really focus on these great writers and thinkers through time, because yes. I feel woefully ill-read because I just didn't read that stuff growing up, and I feel like I'm just now getting to it. And I'm, because of my job, I'm kind of starting with great writers, Rothbard, for example, great writers, but there's so much stuff that I haven't read that I'm like, I have like 20 years to catch up on, you know? And if I can have my kids finish, you know, their sort of formal education with us, not feeling like they've missed the boat on, you know, 100 pieces of classical literature.
Yes.
That to me would be a huge win. I think they'd be better thinkers. They'd be better orators. They'd be better readers because of it. So I love this approach, and I think it's really cool what you're doing. Where in Texas is it, just in case anyone's...
Yeah, this is in Northeast Texas, 2 hours east of Dallas, so it's kind of like Piney Woods.
Okay. I love it. Well, I wouldn't be surprised. I feel like more people are waking up to this stuff. I wouldn't be surprised if you've got some people from the suburbs who will make a long haul out to be a part of this, because I think a lot of people are disillusioned by our current educational system.
Yeah, right on.
All righty, let's wrap this up. I got one more question for you. Hopefully you've thought a little bit about it. What is an unpopular opinion that you hold, and you get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners with it?
Yeah, okay. I'll give two. The first one I'll give very quick, and that's I do still think gold will have a place for a number of years, and will move up as we've seen. It just won't move up as fast as Bitcoin. But it also doesn't move down as fast as Bitcoin. So it can kind of be used as a stabilizer of sorts. So that's one thing. And then the second one maybe is more controversial too. You know, while I think Bitcoin is the only sound money that we're going to have, I think that we could figure out a non-monetary uses of proof of work blockchain. Mm. And as an example, you know, Satoshi references Adam Back's hash cash system in the white paper. This was what he put forward to use to stop email spam, because people have to do kind of a proof of work, and that didn't catch on for various reasons. And ultimately, like, the email centralized, where just a few giants like Google and Microsoft and whoever control like the whole email system. So like they're able to like keep email spam down okay. But mm-hmm. we could have had a decentralized system with a proof of work that could have worked. And people had to spend real energy to do it. So none of those things would have to become money like Bitcoin. It'd just be something useful. And is a thought experiment. This guy, Jason Lowry, has this book called Soft War, where he gestures towards some of these things in a military defensive type of context. Mm-hmm. In that book also has been controversial. I think the government made him quit selling the paperback. You can find him online and stuff. And some Bitcoiners are mad at him too, because they're like, no, it can't be used for, you know, you can't use it for anything but money. And you shouldn't be talking about this. But that's something I think that we could explore. Are there other uses that are not money that could be used in a clever way?
Yeah, no, I like that. I haven't thought about it hard enough to say I definitively agree or disagree. I would need to like think through the use cases, because like for email spam, for example, what I've thought is each email you send is one sat. You know, like if the service provider said, hey, the way we're going to filter out spam is putting a monetary cost, you could tie that back to, well, there was proof of work done to acquire that sat. It may not require that you're running, you know, you're expending energy per se directly, but indirectly to acquire that sat to send that email, you know, you've done that. I wouldn't be surprised if you're right about that. I haven't thought about it enough. To say with certainty what I believe. I always thought Jason Lowry's thesis, at least as he described, I didn't read the entirety of Soft War, at least in the way he described it on podcasts, I think made a lot of sense. I think a lot of people were turned off by his, you know, the way he'd approach it is, it seemed sort of to run counter to this peaceful revolution that we tend to talk about.
Right.
And so I understand sort of the knee jerk. My sense is that there was validity to a lot of what he said. Whether or not I agree with the whole thing, I just haven't dug into it deeply enough. But yeah, sure. I think that's an interesting concept. I do agree with you on gold. It's not that I don't own gold. I'm not obviously not a gold bug. I'm here at the Bitcoin Way, you know, working full time on Bitcoin. But I think the fact that we see gold reaching all-time highs as uncertainty abounds, I think that to me indicates we're going to have a longer haul to get to where it's just Bitcoin. I'm fortunate. If I were 60 years old, 70 years old, I would probably have a mixed bag of Bitcoin and gold just for like stability for the next 10 or 20 years, because I don't know the pace at which Bitcoin is going to win. I just know it will. I'm fortunate to be in my mid-30s. It's much easier for me to bet on Bitcoin long-term and to imagine that later in my life, I'm going to benefit from picking the right form of money that wins in the market. I love this. Right. But I do agree, even though I probably tend toward agreeing with you on these things, at least the concepts I've thought about, I think you're going to make some people mad with that. So I love it.
Yeah, good. People get awesome. Mad, then we'll talk about it.
Awesome. Well, hey, why don't you give a handoff? Tell people where they can find you, find your book, anything else you want to tell them about.
Yeah, the book is Chasing the Seeds. It's part of the Fiefdom Chronicles. Will probably be at least five books or four or five books. And you can find that on Amazon. And then on X, I'm Devin S. Rose. And so, thanks for having me, Michael. It's been great chatting.
This has been a lot of fun. We need to catch up again. Once I read the book, once it comes here in the mail, I'll get on it and we can chat about it. I'm sure I'll enjoy it and really do appreciate what you're doing. We need more people doing creative work around Bitcoin and introducing people in different ways. I think art and literature are some fantastic ways to orange pill the world. So thank you for all that you're doing.
You're welcome. Thank you, Michael.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.
And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I know I sure did. Do me a favor, go check out Devin and his work. Go buy his book on Amazon. I think even if you're not a person who loves fiction, I'm not typically a fiction guy, but I'm going to check out the book and give it a read, because I do think that there are going to be people in my life who would find that more accessible than maybe some of the more textbooky content that's typically out there related to Bitcoin. And of course, if you need help with Bitcoin in proper 100% self-custody, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. set up a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We'd love to talk you through how we help train you to do this the right way the first time without any compromise. We also help with online privacy, privacy phones. We have a Plan B residency option. Go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast to learn more. Until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.